Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Well, this past week, we got two hot inflation prints. We're talking about CPI and PPI, as well as the latest minutes from the FOMC, and all signs point to the Fed staying hawkish for the foreseeable future.
Federal Reserve officials committed to raising interest rates to, quote, restrictive level in the near term and holding them there to curb inflation. We're going to talk about the policy and the risks involved throughout the next hour.
Because it just hits and impacts everyone and every business. Meantime, it looks like Elon Musk's $44 billion deal for Twitter, it is on track, and the social media giant could be in for a rough ride once it's official. That's the subject of the cover story in our special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week.
All of that to come. We begin with the remarks section of Bloomberg Business Week. Bloomberg Markets Magazine editor Christine Harper writes about Paul Volcker's inflation fight during the 1980s, and how it hints at what lies ahead for Jerome Powell.
Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber and Christine are here to break it down. Christine also co-wrote Keeping At It, The Quest for Sound Money and Good Government with the late former Fed chair.
Well, I can tell you, when he was writing his memoir back in 2017, 2018, nobody was paying attention to inflation. In fact, if they were at all, it was in an effort to get more inflation, right? So he was quite concerned that people were underestimating the risks. And so part of the mission of the book was to remind people of how important the central bank's role is in keeping inflation down and maintaining that credibility that he fought so hard to maintain. I mean, he had been involved in getting the dollar off the gold standard. And after that, the dollar was not, it was not connected to any actual value. And so when inflation took root, he had to, you know, drive interest rates up to unprecedented levels, cause all kinds of pain for people, for financial institutions. And the result was there was more credibility in the dollar. It, some people talked about it went on the Volcker standard from the gold standard. But, you know, that's something you can't squander because he fought so hard. So it's kind of like having gone to war, you know, to win a battle and then discover that your future, you know, commanders are allowing you to give up the territory again. So he would have been very upset that inflation was allowed to get to where it was.
You got to know Mr. Volcker very well. I'm curious what you think, if anything, Powell might have learned from him, and if not him directly, then the book.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as you and I have discussed, I mean, one of the things that's so interesting is how often Fed Chairman Powell invokes not only Volcker himself, who he says he's a great admirer of, but the book. I mean, he talks about everybody should read it, and he has used this phrase, keep at it, which people see as a echo of the title, Keeping At It. And, you know, I mean, one thing that Volcker made clear was when I was speaking to him was how much he supported Powell as Fed chairman, because he liked the fact that Powell had this, similar to Volcker, had this experience of having worked in the in a private financial institution and also working at the Treasury Department. So understanding markets, understanding the government is really important to being practical in the job and not just being an academic theorist.
Christine, how tough was it for Volcker to hike rates? Like, what were some of the conversations that you all had about that, which was going against what everybody wanted, but it was necessary in order to right the situation?
Well, to that point, I mean, he said that when he came into the role, it was clear. I mean, the reason he was brought in really was to do something about inflation that his predecessors hadn't really succeeded in bringing down. Even so, at that point, the economists at the Fed were forecasting a recession. So he had to sort of ignore that and just say, we're going to raise rates. There was a split on the Federal Reserve Board on the second time they voted. And so the markets didn't believe there would be any stronger action. They thought the Fed was going to lose their spine. And so he turned to this monetarist approach of just targeting the money supply. And that essentially told people, we're tying our hands and we're going to let interest rates go where they have to go. And they went up to like 20%.
Yeah. That's pretty remarkable.
Okay, so I've got to ask a question, because this book almost had a different title.
Oh, yes.
And we got to talk about that because it's just this little Easter egg. Can you talk to us about the parrot?
Sure, of course. So he opened the book with this very funny joke about a wise parrot who's known as the chairman. He went so far as saying he wanted to title the book, The Wise Old Parrot Speaks. Now, the marketing department and I all agreed that was not a great title for this book. So we spent weeks trying to offer him other ideas, all of which he rejected. So we were really going back and forth. It was one of the most difficult things of working with him, because he was so stubborn on this. And so finally, one day, I was going through this long list of titles I'd come up with. You know, I found a phrase from the Fed, sustained commitment. And he looked, and he stopped, and he said, keeping at it. And it was great, because that really was him. You know, he believed in speaking plainly. And, you know, so he took the kind of jargony phrase and translated it.
Hey, Christine, I just want to talk a little bit about his legacy. Given what we know about the 1980s and what markets did and what inflation did after he raised rates so significantly, what's in store this time around?
I think everybody is seeing that interest rates are going to go up. Policymakers are making it very clear they're not going to back down on this. If they show any signs of, you know, weakness, I think people understand what will happen is kind of what happened to Paul Volcker's predecessor. So I think that is an example of where Powell sees he has to be steadfast. But the chapters that follow the inflation fight are a series of financial crises that Paul Volcker's Fed had to deal with in the wake of the interest rate increases. And so, you know, when you hear these experts talking about something might break, I think, you know, what we saw back in the 80s was a lot of things broke. A lot of risks were built up, everything from the Hunt brothers' speculation on silver to Continental Illinois, savings and loans, all these different banks that went belly up. The ultimate one was the Latin American debt crisis. Mm. And that was so bad that in 82, I think that was really what caused Volcker to say, okay, we've got to back off and stop the inflation fight. So ultimately, it is often that something breaks, that there's a financial crisis.
That was Bloomberg Markets editor Christine Harper, along with Business Week editor Joel Weber.
Coming up, we'll look at a sector highly influenced by monetary policy, real estate, how the world's largest owner of commercial real estate is adapting to higher rates.
The co-head of Blackstone Real Estate is up next. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This past week, Bloomberg Live hosted Invest. It's an annual gathering of the leading names covering areas from crypto to credit markets and everything in between, anything that's investable. And it was in person for the first time since the pandemic.
It's a time of market volatility and uncertainty.
No.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that again, right?
Yeah.
This is global central banks continue to raise interest rates in an effort to bring down inflation. One area of the market we're watching closely as these conditions evolve is real estate. And Carol, you caught up with an executive from the largest owner of commercial real estate globally.
That's right, Tim. We're talking about Blackstone. Kathleen McCarthy is the global co-head of Blackstone Real Estate, which has a $577 billion portfolio and $320 billion in investor capital under management. I began, though, with asking her, how things are going against all these macro concerns.
It is an exciting and interesting time because, as you can see, there's different signals coming through. And I think we are better positioned than anyone to know what's really happening. We have $600 billion of real estate. We're in 37 different countries. A portfolio, though, that's highly concentrated into four key themes. 80% of our capital is in warehouses, rental housing, lab office, and hospitality investments. And what I'd say we're seeing is actually very strong fundamentals in those sectors. So when you talk about property performance, particularly for rental housing, that continues to be strong, partly because of the pressures on the for sale market with rising interest rates. Logistics demand, so warehouses. In the U.S. today, we are at record low vacancies, less than 3% vacancies in the markets we operate in, which are the densest, most urban kind of areas. And we're also seeing very strong rent growth. And so I think when we're thinking about the real estate market, we continue to see a lot of strength, notwithstanding there are pressures around us in terms of interest rates and persistent inflation. But we feel really well positioned for that. And I'd also highlight that I think this moment in real estate, this cycle, is quite different than others we've been
different,
in the
good,
past.
Different, good, different, bad.
I'd say good, different. I mean, good, different. When you think about what kind of led to real estate downturns in the past, there were really two primary factors. It was too much capital, generally in the form of debt, creating greater leverage, fueling new speculative development. And it was too many cranes, too much development. And really, when you think about what happened in the years following the financial crisis and leading up into COVID, we really never saw those excesses come into our market. And so as we head into a period where there may be more economic headwinds, real estate actually is really well positioned from a fundamental standpoint.
Economic headwinds or recession?
It's very hard to call. And I'm not.
Why is it so hard?
I think part of it is what we're seeing and some of the things that I think the central governments are trying to combat, which is just this continued strength. They see low unemployment, mm-hmm. strong rent growth. And that is part of what the big challenge is ahead. So I don't know if we're going to have a recession. I'm not an economist, but I would say we've been planning for a long time, and this comes through in the portfolio we've constructed for an environment that might have been like this in terms of higher interest rates, higher inflation. And so we really focused on trying to be in those high cash flow growth mm-hmm. assets. And again, I'd say today we're still seeing those stronger than inflationary cash flows in our portfolio. But certainly, we are always trying to position for environments that change. We've been doing this for 30 years. We've seen a lot of different environments. We thought we had seen it all. And then COVID hit and hotel revenues went to zero. I'm telling you, no one underwrote that before we had a pandemic. But the great news is our portfolios are built really to try to withstand any kind of environment. And the higher than anticipated rent growth we've experienced, again, may kind of come down modestly. But we feel really well positioned for that.
And distress for you guys can be opportunity, big time. We saw that after the financial crisis in terms of housing.
I would say environments with distress, with volatility, with a pullback in capital markets activity, and we're seeing in particular much more constrained capital markets today, that tends to be a great environment for us and really for any investor who is well capitalized and who has real strengths to lean on. So we have a data advantage. Our portfolio gives us more information on what's really happening. And then I'd say the combination of deep experience from a large team and capital makes us well positioned to really support situations where others may be needing to sell assets, others might need liquidity, and we're able to then get in and buy high quality real estate.
I want to ask you, this week on Bloomberg, Greenwich Economic Forum, Sam Zell commenting, retail is still very much a falling knife, and that the office market will see a lot of downward repricing. And then you had Barry Sternlicht at the Robinhood Investors Conference, of Starwood, of course, Capital Investors, says he sees incredible opportunities to find distressed investments in the real estate market. First, retail, falling knife, do you agree?
I think retail has been under pressure for a long time, and that's a big part of why we have not bought a shopping mall in the U.S. In over a decade. Yeah. There are pockets that are showing greater strength, so grocery-anchored shopping centers in dense urban areas, but I'd say overall, it's one of the asset classes can more under pressure, and in our business, we played the counterpoint of that, which was warehouse investing. So retail, brick and mortar, the movement of goods online is really what started that challenge. It was against a backdrop of oversupply in a lot of places. And so but there's always kind of other opportunities. And for us, it was, okay, how do we invest in the warehouses that are benefiting from the retail activity moving to a different format? But I'd say, continuing to see pressure in an area where we are more cautious.
But like India, retail's a different story. Because you guys are global.
We are global.
We have to remember that.
Yeah. And I'd say there's overall been great consistency in the themes where we invest in globally. I think a market like India is a differentiated story, though. So in India, we're now one of the largest owners of shopping malls in the country. But there are, I'd say, overall, relative to a population that has 1.4 billion people, there are very few of them. And so it's a very different story. It's a country where the growing middle class, greater consumption, people looking to more toward organized retail as a place. They want to go not only to shop, but eat out and have experiences. And again, not so dissimilar to what are the formats of retail that are going to thrive anywhere in the world. It's something offering, you know, more than just a place to go buy something. It's got to offer that kind of, you know, experience, community, and you know, a whole variety of things that will attract people to those stores. So our investment in India has been very successful. We made it, I think, at a great time also where there was a lot of change happening in the retail sector. More international retailers were able to access that market, and that really led to a lot of strong leasing velocity for the assets we were in. So a little bit different. And that's one of the, you know, the great things that's so fun about our business is we have teams all over the globe. And while certainly there are asset classes like retail where we have a more cautious posture, we have the opportunity to dig in and understand what's happening, you know, regardless of whether we know at the time it's going to be kind of an area to really dig into and do more.
Right.
That was an example where the team kept at it, kept thinking about standing the problem and the challenge and the opportunity on its head and said, you know, this is a very different market. And I feel really proud that we have an investment committee that keeps an open mind to that and says, we know where we kind of want to go, but right, where the other opportunities present themselves and we can invest in scale, we're going to activate that.
That was Kathleen McCarthy. She's the global co-head of Blackstone Real Estate.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, why the Russia-induced energy crisis and the inflationary fallout is putting the White House in a high-stakes catch-22.
For this president, it's really a matter of balancing these geopolitical concerns with very real domestic economic concerns.
The growing wave of so-called resource nationalism explained. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
High energy prices are stoking inflationary pressures around the world. You know that. And here in the U.S., they are putting the Biden administration in a really difficult position. This story in the economics section of the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week.
It explains why the president is now walking a tightrope as the world hungers for U.S. oil and gas, while American consumers fret over sticker shock at the pump. For more, we turn to Bloomberg News energy and environmental policy reporter Jennifer DeLowey.
Well, really, we're seeing this kind of resource nationalism across the world as countries look to meet the needs of their own consumers and amid inflationary pressures, and then also take care of other geopolitical concerns. In the case of the U.S. and the Biden administration, really, the concern is around energy. The president is feeling tremendous pressure to help European allies deal with energy needs, especially ahead of this winter and next year, because of the Ukraine crisis and energy concerns that have been exacerbated by that situation. But at the same time, he's also trying to deal with domestic needs and concerns by American consumers that the price of food and energy is going up. Of course, they're dealing with, you know, gasoline prices that are increasing. And in the Northeast U.S., there are concerns about home heating oil this winter. So, you know, for this president, it's really a matter of balancing these geopolitical concerns with very real domestic economic concerns.
You know, Jennifer, it's a U.S. story, but it's also a global story. I think about India bans some exports of wheat, you know, citing a risk to its food security, partly due to the war in Ukraine. I guess it was earlier this year. I mean, this is commodities or fossil fuels. People remind us it's a fixed amount, right? At some point, we're all going to be competing for the same stuff unless we shift to alternative modes.
Right. That's absolutely true. You know, other examples, palm oil, Indonesia, you know, beans in Mexico. It's far bigger than just energy. Energy just happens to be in America, in the United States. It happens to be just such a big political and economic pressure point, a big contributor to inflation. And of course, you know, America is an energy superpower. We are a large supplier of oil and gas to the world. And right now that puts the president in a really unique spot. Interestingly, some of the bid to control the exports and the outflows of these products might not necessarily have the economic impact that American consumers want, but that's part of the calculus that the White House is weighing right now.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what difference it would actually make if they were to curb some of these exports?
Right. So the consideration is curbing really petroleum product exports, gasoline or diesel, not actually crude oil. And that's a live discussion right now within the administration. It would have a mixed impact and it would not necessarily reduce prices across the country. In fact, some areas of the country would see gasoline and diesel price increases. So the Gulf Coast and the Midwest, which is flush with refineries, would end up being flush with product. So gasoline prices would likely decrease if you were to clamp down on exports of that product. But some areas of the country that are really restricted and don't have enough domestic supply coming in, who are reliant on imports to meet their needs, which includes New England as well as the West Coast, those areas would likely see price increases. That's something that we're hearing universally from analysts and energy experts. So, you know, this might look good. It might be a positive move to some constituents, but the economic realities just don't seem to support it.
All right. So what's likely? Because this is tricky, right? Certainly the United States, when it comes to energy, has to think about its own citizens, but it's also got some allies out there that are very important. What's the strategy that the U.S. is likely to pursue?
Well, we know that the administration is going to continue to turn to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, where they have already tapped, you know, U.S. stockpiles of crude in a bid to keep the market in balance and to keep prices down. The Biden administration started to unleash an unprecedented release of those crude reserves in spring of this year and still has some latitude to draw down barrels and release those onto the market. So that's something we're going to keep seeing. And they're going to keep exploring some of these other creative options, whether it's limiting exports or perhaps requiring refineries to hold more stockpiles in the U.S. And that's really a bid to deal with not just the price concern, but also a very real concern about domestic stockpiles of fuel being at incredibly low levels heading into winter, and particularly in New England, where home heating oil and diesel supplies are at historic lows.
In the meantime, we see gas prices right now at $3.92 on average. That's coming from the Automobile Association of America, AAA. Still, though, higher by more than 6% from the lows in earlier this month. And I'm wondering about these continuing to climb higher just before the midterm season.
Yeah, huge political concern and headache for the administration. You know, prices hit their high in June, but the fact that they're going up and they're going up significantly on the West Coast, it's a real political concern for this White House.
A big thanks to Bloomberg News energy and environmental policy reporter Jennifer DeLoey. Be sure to check out her story in the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Find it online and also on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, despite a brutal 2022 for digital assets, financial heavyweights are now offering crypto services to clients and delving deeper into the space.
Executives from T. Rowe Price, Citigroup, and Susquehanna joined Tim for a special Bloomberg Invest panel. They talk Bitcoin, blockchain, and the broader business of crypto. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This past week, Bank of New York Mellon launched a digital asset platform in the U.S. It's going to allow some clients to hold and transfer Bitcoin and Ether. It's just the latest example of traditional financial firms wading into the still nascent crypto industry. I mean, we're talking about the oldest bank in the U.S. now offering crypto custodial services.
Which is wild and says a lot. Well, as we noted earlier, the Bloomberg Live team hosting our latest Bloomberg Invest event this past week. And as part of the festivities, Tim hosted a panel discussion focusing on the wider adoption of crypto among asset managers and institutions.
Yeah, we had three great voices on the panel. Blue Macellari, she's head of digital strategy at T. Rowe Price. Puneet Singhvi is Citi's head of digital assets institutional clients group. And Bart Smith is the global head of digital asset strategy for Susquehanna International Group.
Tim, you began by asking Blue whether the latest crypto crash should be looked at differently from downturns of the past, with investors in the space out more than $2 trillion collectively this year.
You know, I had been in traditional finance and I left 5 years ago to go to a crypto native startup. And I started right at the beginning of the last crypto winter. So our first track record day was January 1st, 2018. And within months, the whole space had just kind of, a lot of it had evaporated. There were, you know, desks that were closed at banks, institutions pulled back dramatically. What we're seeing this time is that even though we're in another crypto winter and we've obviously had this big drop in market cap, the institutions are still committed and moving forward with plans. And we saw the announcement yesterday from Bank of New York Mellon, which, you know, everyone knew that they were working on this, but the institutional commitment is there in a way that it wasn't in 2018. And I think it's no longer an existential question on like, well, will crypto cease to exist?
Why is that institutional commitment here now and it wasn't here in 2018?
It was such a new technology and a new space. And we saw what looked like a significant bubble, a run-up. And when the bubble burst, and we, like, the floor back then in 2018 was like, we're talking like 6,000, like, as a price point for Bitcoin. So it was a huge drop. You know, a lot of people who were already skeptical said, okay, this is it. Like, you know, crypto is going to cease to exist. I think that institutions and the market more broadly have embraced this and continue to stick with it. And I think that there's a real generational piece that people are starting to recognize as well.
Bart, jump on in here because you started in the current position that you're in, which is global head of digital asset strategy at Susquehanna, December of 2021. So right as the air was starting to come out. What were the conversations that you guys were having about sticking with this versus saying, wait a second, this might not be something we should do?
So I was involved in kind of the 2016, 2017 phase. The firm has been involved in Bitcoin in particular for a long time, mostly just buying it proprietarily in kind of 2014, 2015. You know, we did have a build out in 2017 of a desk that was, you know, providing liquidity for retail platforms and some limited institutional customers, the limited few that there were there. And really what we've seen is this infrastructure being built out, right? So there's a lot of institutions, pensions, endowments, foundations who don't want to or can't practically use crypto native infrastructure. Right, so even something like Coinbase, which is a very well-known name, it's listed, you know, on the equity market. If you work at a pension or you work at an endowment, getting that on as a custodian is like a Herculean task. And so when you see firms like Bank of New York Mellon and State Street, you know, with BlackRock announcement that they're going to have it on the Aladdin program, which the vast majority of institutions use as a critical piece of infrastructure, I think that's the piece that in Blue's comments, that is different now. I've wanted to invest in it, but I don't want to have to set up new vendors and new fixed line connectivity. I don't want to have to get new software. I can't use, you know, a non, you know, brand name custodian. And all of those solutions, while they haven't fully fixed themselves, you can see it on the horizon of that infrastructure being usable.
But Bart, where's the drive coming from? Is it coming internally or is it coming from clients externally? Like clients, and then of course their clients want access to it. Is that what it is?
I think you're seeing from our perspective, right? Because we obviously trade in the spot markets, we trade in equities, but the kind of bread and butter of Susquehanna is derivatives, right? Futures and options. And you're seeing a world where, you know, when you get to like a real kind of bona fide prime brokerage solution, where I can not only, you know, cross margin my collateral for different crypto products by asset class and by, you know, investment type, like so options and futures, where in the equity markets or traditional markets, they're all fungible. Now you're talking about real scale, and you're seeing real institutions who can do strategies, and it has the liquidity that they would need for like a Brevin Howard to run a macro fund or a D.E. Shaw. And these brand names, they're not going to mess around in an asset class where they can get like $50 or $100 million of liquidity when they need $1 billion of liquidity. And there's partners out there now like Susquehanna who can provide that. And so as these infrastructure things continue to get built out, you will see the types of strategies that people can to run right now are growing. And like the whole world is driven by macro, right? Like, every headline, whether it's interest rates or central bank activity, it's just driving everything. And like, what a great high beta way to express your opinion in that space than trading Bitcoin derivatives and options and running strategies that you would typically run for commodities and currencies in this asset class. It's an amazing asset class as far as efficiency to express a view that way. And now you're seeing firms like ours who can provide liquidity that provides the infrastructure for them to do it.
Puneet, how are you thinking about this at Citi? I mean, you've been at this firm for what, 20 years in many different roles. This is a relatively new role for you.
It's very fascinating kind of how this brings everything together from payments to trade finance to foreign exchange or custody, and very uniquely. Just from a capability perspective, so one whole side, I mean, obviously the whole side's about $1 trillion. The global financial markets are a few hundred trillion dollars. So when you think of pure capability lens of it, does it provide new set of capabilities which could actually enable additional efficiencies, functionality into traditional markets?
So,
and do we expect like this crypto to run in parallel? Do we actually see some level of overlap between the two?
So you're talking about underlying technology that helps TradFi?
As one of the components.
What does that look like?
Yeah, so if you think of traditional component here, you think of Ethereum. This is one platform where you have money, you have different forms of assets. In traditional markets, we have different systems and different infrastructures supporting different components of the financial market. Also, which is very distinct between different firms. So if you have one platform which could actually bring money together with securities and could actually enable new ways of settling, a new way of communicating between different institutions, that could be pretty unique. Now, obviously, we are in the early stages of all of this. Technology scalability is an issue because it is not as scalable as some of the centralized infrastructure is. It is not as robustly tested as some of the current infrastructure is. But we are in the initial stages of a multiple POCs, which I call as tokenization. Mm-hmm. Tokenization of collateral, tokenization of private funds, and you saw the announcement KKR made recently. Very initial days, collateral tokenization of real estate, and a lot of real estate assets are tied up in illiquid form. Could we actually have a way in which we can drive liquidity in that? So bonds, and typically bond sizes are very large. Could we actually fractionalize them in a more efficient fashion for retail customers to access? All of those are use cases which you're looking at.
Is the government going to let you do this?
Yeah, obviously it has to be in a very well-regulated format. The risk tolerance of regulators when it comes to value transfer networks is very low. And it'll be very true for issuers and investors. They want to ensure that they're really not worried about the risk which is underlying in the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So it's very critical that all these pieces are done in a very well thought of fashion.
Hey, Blue, you were at a crypto shop for 5 years before this, and now you're at a firm that's 85 years old, trying to, you know, make it more digital first, focused on digital assets. How do you do that?
I think that one of the things that's sort of core to T. Rowe DNA is growth and innovation. So growth, like investing in growth strategies. So while blockchain is a new technology, technology itself isn't new to T. Rowe. So, you know, for the past 3 years, we've had analysts who have been really building out robust, foundational, fundamental research across the ecosystem, trying to understand the different pieces and how everything comes together. And I think, recognizing that crypto markets have gotten to a size where they will impact and interact with traditional markets is part of what led to the creation of this role. We have one of our analysts, Dante Pearson, who does amazing work in this space. And the way that he sort of explained it to me was that we need to be looking at everything in the early, early stages. We can't show up when something goes public and be like, let's cover it, right? You have to understand how all these different pieces fit together. And that fundamental research, that like drive to understand things, is very core to the way that T. Rowe approaches things. And I think that that's something that's where there's a lot of overlap with crypto. And I think it is the right way to think about and approach crypto, right? Like, you shouldn't start with answers. You should start with questions.
That was Blue Machellari of T. Rowe Price, Puneet Singhvi of Citi, and Bart Smith of Susquehanna. Catch the full panel and more from some of the world's top financial executives. You can do that by going to BloombergLive.com and searching our Bloomberg Invest event.
That wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, we're going to dig into the state of the retail sector. We're going to do that with Vuori CEO Joe Kudla and Notori company president Ken Notori. And the CEO of SoundExchange explains how his company uses data to get music creators paid.
Plus, we've got our cover story.
No matter what happens, you know, Twitter, the company, is going to look and feel very different.
The troubled path ahead for a social media stalwart. This is Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com. Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including the CEO of SoundExchange on shaping the future of the music industry and the way in which creators cash in.
Plus, an up-close look at the retail sector with Vuori CEO Joe Kudla and Notori company president Ken Notori.
First up this hour, this week's cover story. The tale that keeps on giving, and it isn't over yet. Elon Musk's pursuit of Twitter. Businessweek editor Joel Weber is back, and Bloomberg News tech reporter Kurt Wagner joining us as well to explain why the platform faces only bad outcomes if Elon's $44 billion deal closes.
I think it became abundantly clear that no matter what happens, you know, Twitter, the company, is in for a crazy ride. And, you know, if Elon gets Twitter, as we are starting to expect, you know, that's going to lead to layoffs, cost cuts. They're going to rescind a lot of the rules around speech and misinformation is the expectation. So, you know, suddenly this service that's incredibly important is going to look and feel very different. And the company is going to look and feel different. Now, if for some reason this deal falls apart, suddenly you still have a company that, you know, has spent the last 6 to 9 months just in total chaos, and they have to kind of pick up and try and pretend like nothing ever happened. And I just don't think that that's realistic either. So, you know, the story was meant to kind of give people a glimpse into what the Twitter employees are feeling right now, which is a lot of chaos.
So, Kurt, we've been talking about this for months. You know, it's obviously probably one of the biggest business stories of the year. And I'm curious, you know, one of the things that you had in here was even some new stuff about, you know, what the employees really felt about their potential new boss. So take us there and sort of these slacks that you were able to get.
Well, there's two scenes that are in the book. The first one is from early 2020. Elon showed up at a Twitter offsite with the entire company, and he complained about bots. And, you know, at that point, everyone kind of just sort of shrugged it off. Like, here's just a popular user who has an issue. Fast forward 2.5 years, and suddenly Elon is still complaining about bots. But now, you know, when he addresses employees in an all hands in June, the vibe is very different, right? It's no longer, here's this outside kind of tech celebrity showing up to give us advice. It's here's the new boss starting to, you know, lay down the future of the company. And employees were not happy. You know, he alluded to layoffs. He alluded to other cost cuts, maybe getting rid of remote work, which a lot of people at Twitter have really come to enjoy. And so on Slack, they're basically mocking their soon-to-be boss as he's speaking to them. You know, there's things like, hey, is it too early to get a drink? Like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And, you know, that just gives you a sense of, like, how unhappy a lot of Twitter employees are with this, right, that they would openly mock kind of the new boss during the opening Q&A with staff. And I just think that it's only going to get worse from here, because there's a lot that's happened in the last couple months to make him even less attractive to a lot of Twitter employees.
Okay, so let's say he has to cut this check, $44 billion, right?
Right.
Like, he becomes, you know, owner of Twitter after all of this. What chess moves go down from there, do we think?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. First and foremost, I imagine he's going to put in, or probably put in, his own executive team. He's been pretty open that he has, you know, no faith in the current leadership at Twitter. We expect that CEO Parag Agarwal will probably be out. Also, the top lawyer, Vijay Gadde, will probably be out. So, you know, there's going to be new people at the top of this company. And then I think the other thing is, you know, he's talked a lot about wanting to bring, quote, free speech back to Twitter, right? And what does that mean? Well, for starters, it means reversing permanent bans. So we might see President Trump back on Twitter quite soon. We might see other people who have been banned back on Twitter. But I also think he sounds like he plans to get rid of a lot of the rules around harassment and hate speech and misinformation that Twitter has been building over the last couple of years. That's going to have a huge impact on just the vibe of what it feels like to scroll through your Twitter timeline, right? And I don't know exactly how quickly all that stuff can be unraveled, but I imagine, you know, Twitter might feel very different to people in the next couple months.
That's a really interesting point, Kurt, and that's one I really wanted to hit on, because there is there's got to be a portion of people who think that this is a good thing. I've seen it play out on Twitter, and you see a lot of of people say, wait a second, this is a good thing for Twitter because, you know, this is going to be more about quote unquote free speech. So what else does it look like on the other side of this if this does go through? Does it actually attract more people? Does it become a more attractive platform? Or do those protections that Musk potentially takes away or could take away, does that hinder people's experience on it?
Well, you know, what's funny is there was a time probably 3 or 4 years ago when Twitter was still very much struggling with all of this hate speech and harassment stuff. And there were people leaving, right? Like, hey, I don't want to be on this hell site. I don't want to, you know, people were saying that they were leaving, right? And then Donald Trump got banned and people said, well, now everyone's going to leave Twitter because they banned President Trump. And in both cases, the numbers didn't really reflect either of those things, right? Like, it was mostly people complaining about this, but the majority of users stuck around. Now, in this case, I think that's probably the same thing that's going to happen, right? There will be people who are happy to see some of these rules rescinded. Some people will be very sad, but for the most part, I imagine most people will probably stick around, at least in the near term.
Hey, Kurt, one thing I'm curious about, too, though, is, you know, Elon Musk has a lot on his plate. Will he ultimately, have a deputy really, you know, running things at Twitter? How do we anticipate it might play out?
Yeah, this is still an unknown. You know, I mentioned that I think the current executive team is probably going to be out the door, but who does he bring in to run the day-to-day? It doesn't seem really feasible for him to do that, considering his responsibilities at SpaceX and Tesla as well. But one thing he did tell employees in June, and that we mentioned in the story, is he said he doesn't really care much about titles. Like, is he the CEO? Is he something else? But he wants to make the decisions. He wants people to listen to him, you know? So I do think he's going to be pretty involved, at least in the direction of where this company is going. Now, is he the one who's going to be, you know, answering emails all day about product tweaks? I don't know. It seems unlikely. But he does claim he wants to be heavily involved here.
That was Bloomberg News technology reporter Kurt Wagner. He wrote the cover story for this week's special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Joel Weber with us once again as well.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, rethinking wealth creation in the multi-billion dollar music business.
The CEO of Sound Exchange joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
It is the only organization designated by the U.S. government to administer the Section 114 sound recording license.
Wait, what?
Listen, you'll learn more. Okay. Nonprofit Sound Exchange collects and distributes digital performance royalties on behalf of 570,000 music creators, and that number is growing. And it's big stars, names you know.
Yeah, they've got to get paid.
Yep.
And to help us understand how the company helps artists collect royalties for the work that they do and the business model that supports it, Carol and I caught up with the president and CEO of Sound Exchange, Michael Huppy.
Well, we're a very interesting billion-dollar company that a lot of your listeners probably haven't heard of, but we make a lot of the services they use work better. And a big part of what we do is help connect 3,600 streaming services like SiriusXM and Pandora and iHeart Online. On the one hand, connect with them and collect payment from them for use of the recordings and the data, and then we take care of all that bad data, clean it up, fix the errors, combine it with the other 3,600 services, and pay it out to over 600,000 creators. Basically, if you are an artist or a label or a studio producer who has play on any of these services, you get a check from us.
Why does it have to be a nonprofit? It
doesn't have to be a nonprofit. We were actually created by the industry to do this very thing. We are purpose-built.
When you say the industry, who got together and created you?
So kind of the entire recorded industry is what came together.
We are RIAA. Made up
of, well, so we have major record labels, indie record labels on our board. We have the artist union, SAG-AFTRA, mm-hmm. AFM. We have artists themselves, artist managers, trade associations. If you are an entity in the music sound recording space, you're represented on the board.
You did mention that you did not mention a couple of big names. You didn't mention Spotify. You didn't mention Apple Music. Those services are on-demand streaming platforms. They're interactive streaming
platforms. There's two types of streaming platforms. One is we call interactive, where you lean forward, you make playlists, and then there's lean back, where it's just a stream of music to you. And we operate a lot in the non-interactive space. We do other things. We're a music tech company, so we have data services that we provide to some folks. We administer certain settlements. But for purposes of this discussion, it's the lean back, non-interactive services that we spend the most time on.
I mean, bottom line, it's tracking, you know, services that are tapping into artist content and making sure that they get paid for it.
Exactly. And to give you a sense of scale, it's exploded. I mean, the music industry, especially the streaming part, has taken off. When I first came to the company, you know, 15 years ago, we were paying out maybe $20 million a year. We now pay out regularly over $1 billion a year. And we pay out very quickly. We pay every month. 90% of the money we get in the door is out within 45 days. Mm. You know, as I said, 3,600 services. We process 35 billion performances a month. Mm-hmm. So it is a serious high-tech, high-data operation.
So if an artist is getting paid because their music is being played on SiriusXM, are they only getting paid because of Sound Exchange, or are they also getting a check from SiriusXM?
For the sound recording part of the business, it generally comes from us. There are other licenses in the music industry as well.
So it's very, very complicated.
It's very complicated. You know, there's a whole other music publishing side of the business, and SiriusXM has to deal with other organizations for that. But for the sound recording, the featured artists get money from us. And another interesting thing, we also send money to a fund that pays all the background vocalists and musicians as well. They now get some downstream revenue.
And you have proprietary technology to make sure that everybody who is creating content at whatever level is getting paid. But I'm thinking about conversations we have. Couldn't the blockchain do this?
Well, one day, mm-hmm. the blockchain may or may not do it. I mean, technology is...
I'm not trying to replace you in your organization, but I wonder how you think about, you've got proprietary technology. Mm-hmm. How do you take it to another level that maybe even makes it purer or more direct?
So I will tell you, for us, all technology, all platforms, they're just tools, right? Yeah. Our job is to work on behalf of creators and make sure they get paid fairly and accurately. And if blockchain becomes the next thing, you're still going to need a place where there's authoritative data about who owns the rights and what recordings and where do they own those rights. So even if you have the blockchain and smart contracts, we would very likely still be a part of that as well. And it's something we're considering for our future. You know, where are we going to be in 10 years? And the blockchain and Web3 is very much something we're thinking about.
Do you see, what is the trend when it comes to the lean back versus interactive experiences? I mean, why isn't Spotify and Apple Music, why aren't they part of your platform?
Well, because they do have lean back experience, but they also have more interactive. And for that, they have to go to the record labels to get the rights.
Will they ever be part of your platform?
Well, look, we're happy to
work. Would you like them to be?
We're happy to work with anybody. You know, if you think about it, we are a trusted resource with, as you say, state-of-the-art, cutting-edge proprietary technology and the best data, music data in the industry. And we would be open to working with any of these companies to help their back office. Saves them money, helps us, you know, serve the industry better. So we would be very open to working with anyone who wants to make it take advantage of that.
What's been the impact of musicians selling their music catalogs? Phil Collins, Bob Dylan, Springsteen. I mean, the list just continues to grow. So what impact has that had on you guys and kind of on the growing monetization, if you will, in the music industry?
Well, I will say it's a fascinating development. You know, looking at this as an asset class now and having these institutional investors invest in an asset class, it's great for the industry. It shows interest. It shows the future and what people expect. From our perspective, it just means, look, we'll send our payments.
Valuations now? Like, does that help in terms of?
Our payments very much work into the valuations because we are, you know, we're a large part of the revenue stream. Sound Exchange alone is 10 to 15% of the U.S. recorded music market. So when these artists go to sell their catalog, the investors are going to look at the history of the revenue, and we are very much a part of that. And from our perspective, you know, we'll pay whoever the artist tells us to pay. If they want us to send 15% to the studio producer, we do. If they, tell us to split the money this way among their bandmates, we will. And if they say, hey, I just sold my catalog to this PE firm, then that's where the check goes.
So do you know an up-and-coming artist before they're an up-and-coming artist because you have this data?
We do have a little bit of insight into trends maybe before they hit the mainstream. So I won't name any names or try not to play favorites, but there are big artists now who we knew and were friendly with.
Oh, come on.
Who's your favorite one?
My favorite, my favorite artist,
Your favorite artist.
Favorite artist? I would say Elvis Costello or Billy Joel.
Nice. I didn't expect you to answer the question.
Well,
they always say you can't
isn't like he's
going to
get them a better deal because of, are you? No, I'm just kidding. Really interesting. And I think a business that we all just take for granted in terms of how it works. So great to get some insight. Come back soon.
I appreciate you having me.
Carol
you
always
much.
Tries me to get me to sing a song on air. And then I'm like, I can't because we don't have the rights to it. So
Piano Man.
Don't get me in trouble. That's Sound Exchange President and CEO Michael Huppy.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, we look at a different type of content creation, this time around in the fashion world.
Live streaming is really the way people shop in many parts of the world, most notably China and throughout Asia, and we're excited to launch it here.
Ken Natori, the president of the Natori Company, on marketing innovation, the strength of the consumer, and the cost of doing business. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Well, for this last half hour, we're going to get to two firms in the retail space, one catering to women, the other all about activewear. First up, when we caught up with our next guest earlier this month, he was literally minutes away from launching the very first live stream on his fashion company's website. We're talking about Ken Natori.
He's a former Bloomberg colleague who is now president of the company created by his mom, Josie Natori. The Natori Company's new digital platform allows customers to engage with designers and stylists and to feel more connected to the brand.
We asked Ken about his firm's foray into content creation, as well as the macro environment with inflation and a tight labor market still posing challenges.
It's been easier in the past. Certainly the last couple of months, there have been a number of headwinds, whether that be inflation, whether that be consumer spending getting hit based on, you know, the stock market being problematic and customers, frankly, just having spent a lot over the past year. So, you know, us as a company, considering where we were in 2020 when the world felt like it was falling apart, we certainly feel fortunate in terms of where we are, but certainly the last couple of months has presented, you know, a good number of challenges.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Ken. Like, how are you? Like, what life was like pre-pandemic? And then, as you said, the pandemic was just so tricky for anybody in your space. And then kind of where we are today. Are you back where you were, you know, pre-pandemic?
Yes, we are. So, you know, we started our direct business early, but we headed into the pandemic, you know, more than 80% wholesale. We planned for good growth for our website every year and planned for wholesale to kind of be flat. And we felt like we were ahead of the curve. Then obviously COVID was very problematic for our wholesale business, but it really led to tremendous growth for online. So all in all, considering where things were in 2020, we do feel, you know, we feel very fortunate. But as I mentioned, you know, certainly there was such a high in 2021 that, you know, companies like us, we felt like, wow, we made it. Consumers are spending. Everything's great. But then, you know, reality has certainly started to hit a little bit.
It's interesting to hear what you see as consumer strengths and weaknesses right now. What about when it comes to actually operating and running your business?
You know, we've been very focused on, you know, employee retention, you know, even before COVID. And I honestly feel like, you know, our efforts there really helped us get through those very difficult years. And certainly, you know, we've been blessed, you know, we've had, you know, great employee retention even throughout the Great Resignation. So, you know, we feel very invested in our team and that has helped. But certainly, you know, we've seen wage pressures go up, inflation really sort of crimp margins across the board.
Hey, just trying to get inside your head. We were just talking about Arvid Pickard, who follows the Fed and the economy. And Ken, this whole this concept of labor hoarding. In other words, a company would rather hold on to a worker because it's been so hard to get workers in this tight labor market. So they would rather hold on to it, a worker, rather than let them go, even if maybe they're starting to see a company that is, see some weakness out there. Do you buy into that? Do you do that?
I do buy into that. But once again, you know, we've been blessed in terms of, you know, really having great employee retention throughout all of this. You know, to the degree we have added jobs, it has been more difficult than ever. You know, I'd say that was especially an issue kind of the first quarter of this year when hiring was just impossible. You know, one benefit of the economy getting softer has been it has been a little bit easier over the last couple of months as we have continued to, you know, to add to the team. But certainly, I think, you know, issues in terms of employee retention and really we feel like this environment is here to stay. And it's really, you know, a big focus for us going forward.
Can you give us any sort of numbers, how much it's costing you or what percentage you've had to raise wages or just the challenges that you're seeing and how it's affected the bottom line?
You know, it's hard to quantify, but, you know, in terms of, you know, our ability to fill jobs before COVID compared to what it was, you know, towards the end of last year and towards the beginning of this year. I mean, we've had job searches that have lasted months and months and, wow. You know, we're fortunately just about full now, but it's a major issue. And so, you know, we certainly, in terms of the cost of training, cost of these searches, it's something that's sort of more cognizant and top of mind than it's been in the past.
All right. Tell us about what you guys are doing in terms of live streaming.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're very excited. As I mentioned, you know, our website, you know, has been a tremendous source of strength, both before COVID and certainly through it. And we're actually launching live streaming from Notori.com. Live streaming is really the way people shop in many parts of the world, most notably China and throughout Asia. And we're excited to launch it here. And I think, you know, more importantly than ever, fashion's about making stuff. But really, customers don't just want stuff. They really want to know, like, who are the people behind this? What does this company represent? So especially as an independent business, as a family business, the ability for us through live streaming to really talk to our customer, for our customer to have that direct interaction and to feel that closer connection to, you know, not just owners, but to employees as well. We think it's really going to be, you know, a big change in terms of the evolution of Notori.com.
Well, speaking of the evolution, I'm wondering how you're thinking about different ways to showcase your products and how you're thinking about the metaverse and Web3 and if there's anything there for you.
Yeah, you know, that has certainly been top of mind as well. you know, metaverse has been a big focus of ours, and we have a partnership, and maybe I'll come back next month when we're able to announce it.
Great.
But suffice it to say, you know, you guys know you've been great to have me on when we've had new collections. We're going to have a new collection coming out that's going to be available, and it's really going to help sort of push us into 3.0.
That's Ken Natori. He's the president of the family-owned Natori Company.
Coming up, another company in the retail space. This one focuses on what to wear when you are out and about and being active.
Our conversation with Vuori founder and CEO Joe Kudla is up next. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Just about 1 year ago, the Southern California-inspired activewear brand Vuori got a $400 million investment from SoftBank. At the time, it brought the company's valuation up to around $4 billion.
Joe Kudla founded the company back in 2015, and he still serves as its CEO. We wanted to know how his team put that funding from SoftBank to work and where the business is today.
Without question, we are dealing with complicated macroeconomic issues on a global scale. But we do feel there's a bifurcation between, you know, best-in-class brands that are leaders in their categories, that are innovating, and folks that are maybe call it middle of the pack, more legacy mass market brands that are seeing, you know, growth really slow as a result of this inflationary environment that we're in. You know, we feel very fortunate to be, you know, experiencing dynamic growth this year. I feel our customer, our relationship with our customer has never been stronger. We're excited about Q4 and holiday. When we look towards 2023, we are being optimistic, but cautiously optimistic. We are planning for another year of dynamic growth. We are going to continue expanding our fleet of retail stores, but we're not trying to swing for the fences. We want to lock in a number that we're really content with, not overinvest in the business, and be responsible with our growth, because there are some macro factors that we're watching very closely, and we just don't know how things will go.
No, and you know, it's interesting too. I think at the time about a year ago of that SoftBank investment, which was just about a year ago, it was reported that you plan to open, Joe, more than 100 stores in the U.S. over 5 years. So as you look at those macro concerns, has that number been reduced, or that plan, that forecast been changed?
You know, it hasn't actually. Okay. You know, the performance of our stores today has never been stronger. We're still very bullish on our vertical retail expansion. You know, four-wall contribution, payback, still best in class. And, you know, we're in a unique position because, you know, relative to the size of the market, Vuori is still very much early stage. You know, we're in our seventh year of selling in market, and there's a lot of opportunity to gain market share as we grow into the years to come. So while we might be in a more challenged macro environment, I think that will be counterbalanced by the growth and taking market share from some of the other more established players.
So talk to us about growth metrics. We're Bloomberg. We're nerdy. We love all these numbers. So talk to us about top and bottom line growth. Give us an idea. Same store sales growth. What have you guys been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, this year we're seeing, you know, the business is going to grow north of 70%, you know, between 70 and 80% top line at a pretty sizable scale. It's a number that we're very proud of. You know, our same store sales are still comping very strong over prior years, demonstrating, you know, that, you know, it's still very much early in our awareness curve. People are experiencing the brand. We're converting them into loyalists. They're shopping with us for years to come while acquiring more new customers. So we see really great year-over-year growth in our existing fleet. And then, you know, as we expand the network across the country, you know, we're leveraging e-commerce data so we can be really intelligent about where we go. And we tend to open strong. And I think that trend is really accelerating as the brand builds more and more awareness.
Joe, how are you doing with inventory right now? We saw inventory challenges, of course, from Nike just in the last couple of weeks, not to mention, you know, companies that we can't necessarily compare you to, like Target, for example. How are you managing inventory?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we have definitely seen impacts from this complicated supply chain environment. Although we are seeing it begin to normalize, especially on the logistics side of the supply chain, you know, getting your product in containers, getting it on boats and delivering on time, that has become much more normalized. The cost of a container, you know, from Asia to the West Coast of the United States, you know, pre-pandemic was, you know, call it $2,500 to $3,000. It went up as high as $18,000, now back to pre-pandemic levels or materially close to pre-pandemic levels. So the logistics aspects of supply chain have normalized, where we're still seeing a lot of challenges in the ability to source raw materials and get them delivered to your factory partners on time. So what happened to the larger marketplaces, you know, your spring deliveries delivered late, that created promotion as we transitioned from spring and summer into fall. And then you saw the same thing happen, you know, and it was a double whammy with the deliveries of fall being material delayed for a lot of our peers. And that's putting a lot of pressure on inventory levels. That's why a lot of folks anticipate highly promotional holiday coming up. Vuori, while we're not immune to these challenges, we've stayed very close to our supply chain. We've dealt with delays, but nothing that's been catastrophic. And we've been able to maintain our full price business, which has been a goal of ours since we launched in the spring of 2015. And we don't anticipate an overly promotional holiday.
Joe, you probably know better than anybody else the competition that's out there, whether it's, you know, those giant brands, including Nike, you've got Lululemon, you've got Under Armour. I mean, it's a super competitive market that could be on track for some slowing growth because, you know, what we're seeing is people are going back to the office. I've stopped wearing my yoga pants during work. You know, I'm back wearing, you know, what I would call grown-up clothes in a big way. So tell us, you know, what's the competitive advantage that gives you the optimism that you can continue on your growth trajectory?
Yeah, I think
and compete with those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great point, you know, and it's interesting. When we launched the brand, we were facing this competition and we saw nothing but open space. And I think it's due to our product positioning, our brand positioning, the ethos of the brand, which is built to move in style for life. And it all comes down to building product that will support you in a workout, but it'll transition and work across multiple aspects of your life. And so we prioritize fabrications that have performance at their core, but they're incredibly soft. We design all of our products with a more modern athletic fit that works across multiple aspects of your life. And we design our product with an aesthetic, a color story that is sophisticated, that doesn't identify you as somebody going to the gym or going to compete in a sport, but it just, again, works across multiple aspects of your life. That was always the premise of the brand. And we applied it first and foremost to activewear, a product that you would move and sweat in. But the brand has really evolved. And when you look at our assortment and where we're growing, it's evolved from core fitness into outdoor, which is rooted in outerwear. Yeah. And the fastest growing segment of our brand is travel commute, which is taking the lessons, those technical fabrications and constructions that we applied to activewear and applying it to everyday sportswear. And that's one of the fastest growing segments of our collection. And those are the products that you're wearing to the office, you're wearing to travel, you're wearing on the golf course. And so I think our vision to build a more well-rounded collection that speaks to multiple aspects of your life is really benefiting us as you see the preferences of the consumer change.
Joe, there are a couple different directions that it seems like the company could go at this point in terms of trajectory. One of them is the Lululemon route, where you go public. Another one, and forgive me, but this has happened before. I think of a company like Outdoor Voices, which, you know, 5 years ago was the talk of the town and has gone through several CEO transitions and a New York Times profile that essentially said that it imploded after raising about $50 million in funding. How do you avoid the fate of a company like Outdoor Voices?
It all comes down to your people, incredible leadership, alignment of your people, but hire talented people that are much better than yourself. That's been our ethos from day one, is building an incredible, incredible team that can see around those corners, you know, and prioritizing making incredible product. You know, we are maniacal about our products, our level of service. You know, the NPS scores in our stores are off the charts. And I think that's the most important thing. You know, it's a hard comparison. You look at a brand like Outdoor Voices and Vuori. You know, I wasn't great at raising capital in the early days, admittedly. I didn't have a background building an apparel business,
And so the little capital that I did get, I had to make it stretch a long way. And so we prioritized, you know, the basics of business, the fundamentals of, you know, acquiring customers profitably from day one. And we built a business that was profitable from early stage, and we never had to sacrifice that profitability for growth over the years. And I think that's why Vuori received, you know, one of the highest private market apparel valuations ever, is because we've been able to demonstrate a commitment to growth, doing it profitably, and also responsibly with our commitment to ESG and making decisions that prioritize the planet as we're building.
Which is an important part increasingly for consumers. We know that they look at what a company stands for, their impact on the environment. Hey, Joe, just before we wrap up, so what's the end game here? Is it ultimately to go public at some point?
I think that could be a viable outcome. Right now, we're very heads down building the business. We're having a lot of fun. I'm a young man. I've got a lot of energy for the business. We've got big plans for growth, both here in the U.S. as well as abroad. And so today, that's what we're focused on. But, you know, we want to optimize the business and provide the best return for our shareholders. A public offering could be a viable option down the road.
That was Joe Kudla, founder and CEO of the active fashion brand Vuori.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.